Our class tonight, I hope this week is going well for you. We go from the ice early on the Lord's Day morning, apparently to the 70s next day or two. I sure hope you guys can tolerate those hot temperatures like that. First thing you know, you'll be enjoying your dandelions in your yard. In our study this quarter on the scheme of redemption as God's project to make us sharers in His holiness. In other words, to make us into a people who can have fellowship with Him. What we've tried to do is sort of to look at it in two big halves. The first half of this series focused on the holiness of God and what that means and what that must mean in being a holy people. We've tried to say that holiness, that which is holy, is that which belongs to God and is like God and is then used by God for His great purposes. And I hope you kind of remember it that way. And then in the second half of our study, we've tried to take the New Testament and to think our way through the perspectives of holiness that we find in some of the epistles of the New Testament especially. We've tried to show the development of holiness in Colossians, the privilege of holiness in Ephesians, the responsibility of holiness in Romans, and we've tried to think about the difference that holiness makes from the letters of Peter. And tonight, the encouragement of holiness from Hebrews. I wonder how many of us have ever thought of holiness as being a crucial concept where encouragement is concerned. Have you ever thought about that? Usually we think of holiness much more in terms of our responsibility to keep ourselves pure and to do and to be morally upright and that kind of thing. It turns out, however, that in terms of our believing that God has done something or given us something and believing it so strongly that we're prepared to stay with it through weariness and through difficulty, and to be like the people of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, there is something about the concept of holiness that makes that kind of perseverance possible. And the great epistle to the Hebrews is a wonderful illustration of what I'm talking about. I'll warn you ahead of time, this one may take us two Wednesday nights. And the reason for that will be apparent in this first little syllogism I'd like to share with you about the encouragement of holiness. And I mean these to be three equally meaningful statements and not one big one and two smaller ones. There are three facts here, I think. The first is that Hebrews defines itself as a word of exhortation. What does exhortation mean? What's that term mean? Exhortation. All right, it can involve, that's one form of it. It comes from a word that means to call to your side. It means to put your arm around someone and help someone make progress. Make someone strong, to increase someone's resolve, and to cause him to do the needed thing. There are some of the versions that will translate this word fairly consistently as encouragement. It is a particular kind of encouragement. So Hebrews 13, verse 22, the writer refers to his letter, his epistle, as my word of exhortation. So Hebrews is a word of it. Now, in the middle of point, the word holy in some form, and the different forms of the word holy will be holy, holiness, sanctify, sanctification, sanctuary. I haven't mentioned that one much, a holy place, or saint. In some form, that word family appears about two dozen times, maybe one more than two dozen in this book, which means you got about an average of about two per chapter in this book. It's obviously a critical concept for what the writer is trying to say. So I put those two lines of thought together, and I conclude that something about the concept of holiness for Christians must be uniquely encouraging. And I wonder why. And we'll work ourselves, begin to work our way through Hebrews from that perspective tonight. I think that one of the reasons, maybe, is that Hebrews, it's interesting to me, Hebrews does not start with the call for us to live holy lives or for us to practice holiness. Hebrews starts instead by saying, look, holiness has acted to invade the common world. Holiness, the one who makes holy, has come to live among us and to call us his brothers, and that our encouragement and holiness comes from remembering the Lord has, this is a response to something the Lord has done first for us. And it seems to me that when the story in Hebrews starts, this is the idea. Chapter 2, verse 11. The main point of the last half of Hebrews chapter 2 is that we have a great encouragement because the Son of God was made like us in every way so that he can sympathize with us and be a merciful high priest for us. That's the burden of this part of the letter. And in verse 10 of chapter 2, the writer begins by noting that it was fitting that he, that is Jesus, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation, that's Jesus, the Father's doing this, perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies, what does sanctifies mean? To set apart. What in our word here? To make holy, to set apart. He who sets apart, he who makes holy, he who consecrates, and those who are sanctified, those who are made holy, those who are set apart, who would that be? That would be Christians, that would be God's children, are all of one. I noticed the English Standard Version translate this, they all have one source. The New American Standard supplies, they all have one Father. He who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all of one. Now, does that seem to be something that we deserved? Would you have expected that the one who does the setting apart and the ones who are set apart are all of one? Or would it have looked like those were from two very different stations? Well, we know in a sense they're very different stations, but you see what the one who sanctifies has been willing to be made one with the ones that he would set apart. Think about the amazing grace that's implied in that statement. And it goes ahead to say that is why he is not ashamed to call them what? Brothers. Now you think about this. The one who sanctifies, that would mean, according to our definition of holiness, that he owns them. Remember, we said holiness, That which is holy belongs to God. The one who sanctifies, that means he makes them holy, he sets them apart. Well, he obviously would have a place of ownership, and yet he's been willing to call those he sets apart brothers. And that is the astonishing idea with which Hebrews starts to develop the concept of holiness. Now, it goes ahead here to speak of, in the verses after this, to speak of the ways in which this is a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. It mentions in verse 14 that since the children were sharers in flesh and blood, the children here would be the ones who are sanctified, then he himself, that's the one who sanctifies, partook in the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong bondage or slavery. And then it points out this is in fulfillment to the promise to Abraham. And then it mentions that this is done so that he can be a merciful high priest and one who himself has suffered being tempted and therefore can understand and can help those who are tempted. Now think of this. The one who sets apart becomes flesh so that he can call the ones he sets apart brothers, and so that the one who makes holy can take those who are having trouble being holy, that is, they're being tempted, and he can help them. Help them what? Help them be holy, among other things. So the faith of Christ here is not merely a demand that we be holy. It is a call that we respond to what Christ has been willing to do for us. Now, we start with that. That deserves some dwelling on. I hope you'll meditate on it and think about it. Now, we move ahead. Notice in chapter 3 in verse 1, there's the therefore. That means that what's about to be said depends for its meaning on what we have been talking about, what's been said. Therefore, holy, what is it? Brothers. And in the context, this is, therefore, you who have been set apart or made holy by the one who sanctifies or is holy himself, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus. And it mentions him as the apostle and high priest of our confession. And he was the one who is faithful to him who appointed him. Verse 2. And come down to verse 6, the end of the verse. And we are his house or his family if indeed we hold fast our confidence and our boasting in our hope. Holy brothers. We might think about loving brothers, or we might think about beloved brothers, but holy brothers, that's not a term that we find a lot of places in the New Testament. It is one, however, in Hebrews that has a crucial meaning and a great encouragement. Notice that he's saying, why are we holy brothers? Because Christ has been willing to call us brothers. The one who sanctifies is of one with the one, has been willing to be as one with the ones he sanctifies. So, holy brothers. Now, that then means that we have an encouragement. If he who called us brothers is faithful, we have a great encouragement to what? Be faithful, right? I mean, if our hope starts with the claim that the one who sanctifies and those he sanctifies are of one, and the one who sanctifies is faithful, then it's a great encouragement for us to be faithful. So what starts with the idea that he's willing to help us leads to the conviction that we have every reason to be faithful because he is faithful. So you kind of see that there's a line of thought in that. Any point anybody wishes to make, you feel free to holler at me and do that. Think about this now, this next one. Hebrews 6 and verse 10, and I'm just kind of following the line of places through this book where this term comes up. And what this writer does, as you guys know, is he'll get on a teaching of an idea from Scripture. For example, Jesus becoming flesh and so forth. And then again, the section in chapter 3 and chapter 4 about our needing to hold fast to our confidence and not be like that generation that fell in the wilderness because of unbelief. And then he will give an encouragement and then go back to the pursuit of the doctrinal or the biblical subject again. In this case, he has been talking about the danger of that getting discouraged and going backward. And he says in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 6, I have part of verse 10 up here, but verses 9 and 10. Though we speak in this way, yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things, things that belong to salvation. For God is not unjust so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name in serving the saints, as you still do. You know, when you get discouraged, you start thinking that your effort and your sacrifice has all been for nothing. I mean, I think that's right. In whatever field of endeavor you may be active as a Christian, when you get discouraged, you start thinking, well, nobody will remember this. Nobody will know. It won't make any difference. That sort of thing. That's human. What the writer says is, listen, the God who gave you salvation is not going to forget what you do out of love for his name. And another way of saying it, the God who made people holy is not going to overlook or to forget the love you show for his name in serving those whom he has made holy, which is what saints are. Another name for brethren, or another name for the children of God, would be saints, holy ones. And these people are still ministering to the saints, but they're discouraged. And the writer is wanting them to not be. And because they are engaged in doing something for the cause of holiness. Don't overlook that part of this story. All right, now, the Hebrew writer is gradually moving us farther and farther toward what Christ has done for us here. And I'd like you to see that as we move on. Now, in chapter 6, you remember what's happened here. Our hope is in heaven. We have an anchor for our souls where Christ is inside the veil at the end of chapter 6. And then the high priesthood of Melchizedek is introduced, and we talk about it in chapter 7. And in this chapter, we get to verse 26. This is after the statement that says, we have someone who's able to save us to the uttermost if we draw near to God through Him, because He ever lives to make intercession for us. Verse 25. And then 26. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest. And what's the first word used for our high priest? Holy. Holy. Now, just think about for a moment here what function a high priest serves, and why is it that this term here is the critical qualification for his service? All right, he's the only one that could go into the Holy of Holies. He's the only one who could enter the presence of a holy God. Now, if you need a high priest to enter the presence of a holy God, what would be the very first qualification for such service as that? That he be holy. All right. So it's fitting. Can you see what the writer means? It's fitting that we have a high priest like this who is holy and innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. Now, I suggest there might be four definitions of holiness in that verse if you think about it. Innocent would be he's free from sin. Unstained, he's not been the victim to the deceit of being overcome by temptation. Separated means he himself is set apart. And exalted describes the transcendence or the otherness that holiness involves that we've talked about before. And of course, the writer dwells on the implications of these qualifications in terms of there not being a need for another one, and his not having to offer sacrifices for his own sins, etc. A great, fascinating part of the letter to the Hebrews and is involved in this theme of the high priesthood of Jesus. Now, that's the thought we want to pursue now in the middle part of this great book. Back to what Ruth said. High priest, there was only one who can enter the Holy of Holies, and that one time in the year, and not without blood, which he would offer for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. That was the way God educated man to what it would take to enter his presence under the old law. Now, that thought is what the writer returns to again and again in chapters 8 and 9. And notice where he said, it's fitting that we have such a high priest, holy and so forth, in chapter 7, verse 26. He begins in chapter 8. Now, the point in what we're saying is this. We have such a high priest. What kind of high priest? One that fits us. One who's holy. One who is seated at the right hand of the throne of majesty in heaven. A minister in the holy places. This version says. Let me stop right there for just a second with you. In the holy places, there is a term that appears, if I count right, about five times in this chapter and the next one. It is a plural neuter term in the original. And the King James translates it here, sanctuary. Sanctuary would be a holy place. A saint is a holy person. Sanctify is the verb to make holy. And the English Standard Version translates the word, as King James does in a few places, the holy places. King James also uses the holiest or the most holy. But it's this term here. A minister in the holy places in the true tent of the Lord, or that the Lord set up, not man. That's verse 2. In other words, we needed a holy high priest in order to minister in the sanctuary, which God, in the tabernacle which God sets up, which God pitches, and not man. All right? And the encouragement of Hebrews is in chapter 8, verse 1. We have such a high priest. And now, if that thought can't encourage us, then probably we won't find much encouragement in the concept of holiness. If it doesn't humble us and encourage our faith and strengthen us to know that we have somebody at the right hand of the majesty in heaven who is able to make intercession for us, then we miss the wonderful encouragement that the concept of holiness is supposed to embody for us. And I would take it, since then, these two chapters here, since the writer presents this whole matter as if that earthly tabernacle with its first section, which was the holy place, and its second section, which was the most holy place, and all of the work of the high priest and all of that was a shadow of the true thing which God meant to give us through Christ, then I take it that the entire Old Testament system was intended to help us understand what Christ would do for His people in heaven and the privileges that we have through Him. Does that make sense? Do you see it all, what I'm trying to get at here, and what the writer, I think, of Hebrews is trying to get at with us? His point maybe is enlarged on in verse 5, if you look at chapter 8, verse 5 for a second. They serve, and this were the priests and their gifts according to the law, they serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. And it talks about what Moses was told by God, and then there's a discussion of the old covenant, and then there is an introduction of what has happened with the blood of Christ to begin to establish a new covenant and with all of its privileges and promises. Now we come to chapter 9 here, and I mentioned a while ago, what, five times? The other four times when the terms that refer to the holy places are used, the bulk of them occur in this section here, but it is a crucial part of the entire argument of this great letter. So I'd like to call your attention to it for a few moments here. In chapter 9, in verse 1, the argument is that even the first covenant, which was involved copies and shadows, if you remember, had regulations for worship and an earthly, what? Sanctuary. An earthly place of holiness. Earthly holy places, if you will. And you remember with what detail all of that was the pattern was given by God, and then the care with which Moses had it in, had it constructed, and the beauty of it, and the furnishings of it, and all of that, the writer refers to in this part of Hebrews in verse 2, "For a tabernacle was prepared, the first section in which there were the lampstand and the table and the showbread, or the bread of the presence, as this version called it. It's called the holy place." The holy place. Do you notice that? That's the our word. The holy. Why was it the holy place? Because this is where the people met God, and the representative of the priesthood here. And behind the second curtain was a second section called the most holy place. And we've already talked about who went there and how many times of the year and what circumstances. God was not trying to teach them about tents or about rituals. He was trying to teach them about the privilege of being in His presence and what it would take to make that blessing actual for everybody. Now, the argument goes on. He mentions several of the furnishings and the systems of that earthly tabernacle in the succeeding verses here. And we come down, we mention the second, verse 7 of this same chapter. The second, only the high priest goes, and he but once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself. Now, why would he take blood? What was there about blood? All right, and it took, since the wages of sin is death, it took the life and the blood in order to make atonement for sins. And so he would go with blood for the sins of the people. And then verse 8, look at this. "By this, the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy places is what?" It's not yet been made apparent. It's not been, not yet, it was not yet revealed. It's not yet opened as long as the first section is still standing. In other words, as long as that earthly tabernacle was still there, and as long as that high priest once a year took blood into it to make atonement for the sins of the people, it was an acted out lesson in the fact that the way into the presence of the Holy God had not yet been made real by that God. The one who sanctifies and the ones who were to be sanctified were not yet one. There was still separation between them, you see. That's what that whole system bore out every time it was enacted. And verse 9 said all of this was symbolic. According to all of this, all these gifts and sacrifices could not perfect the conscience of the worshiper. That's the end of verse 9. Now, skip down a little bit with me to verses, really I should ask you to look at 11 through 14. Let's just do that for the rest of what time we have tonight. And this makes sense if you bear in mind the argument made thus far, and this is the crux of the argument here. But when Christ appeared, remember, while that first tabernacle stood and all of that was going on, the way into God's presence had not yet appeared. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of good things that to come, then through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is not of this creation, that is God makes it, not man, he entered once for all, where? All right, into the holy places, into the most holy places, into the sanctuary, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by what? By his own blood. Thus securing what? An eternal redemption. For himself, for who? All right, for those who draw near to God through him. Go back to chapter 7 and verse 25. Why could he go there and offer his own blood and that result in our redemption? Because when he went there, he was already a holy high priest. He was already qualified. He did not need to offer any sacrifice for his own sin. There weren't any. And that's the argument the Hebrew writer is making. It's a fascinating and a very profound thing. Now, verse 13. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of the heifer. Now this has to do with cleansing ritual that went along with the sacrifices referred to here. If you go back to Leviticus 16, especially with regard to the Day of Atonement, if you also look at Numbers 19 and some of the cleansing provisions that were involved there with the sprinkling of the ashes of a heifer, if those things sanctify for the purification of the flesh. Now, look what he's talking about. The Old Testament provided for the sprinkling of blood and that ritual with the ashes and so forth. If they would cleanse the flesh as the flesh of a leper being cleansed, then how much more will the blood of Christ, as opposed to the blood of bulls and goats, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, not as a Old Testament high priest who offered the blood of animals for his own sin, but he offers himself without blemish to God, how much more will that purify our conscience, not our flesh, but our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Now, let me ask you a question. What impact does the Hebrew writer expect that this line of thought will have on the minds and the hearts of his readers? What do you think he wants them to feel or to think when he arrives at this grand point in his argument? What did he want them to go away from this reading thinking? All right. Of how they should be encouraged here. That they have what God had worked all of those ages to provide. Eternal redemption, not just a passing thing that comes and goes with our moods and so forth, but eternal redemption. What else do you think that he thought that? Pardon? All right, he wants them to go on wanting to serve God and to please God and to believe it's worth it. What else? All right. He wants them to understand that they have a high priest who is able to bless them and to keep them. He wants them to understand the security of what they have in Christ and to not be thinking that somehow or another God has forgotten them and it's not worth it after all. Anybody else? Can you think of something you think he wants them to feel going away from this? All right, he wants them to be to believe that there is an eternal inheritance. He wants them to be people who desire a better country. He wants them to be people who believe that the reward of Christ is greater than all the treasures of Egypt. He wants them to believe that God is able to do what He's promised and that He's faithful to keep His promises. Those are all the things that Hebrews 11 dwells on along this line of thought. Well, I got some... There's more to this. It's interesting that when the writer has built up to this great claim about the accomplishments of Christ, then he deals with what about the possibility of turning away? What about the hardships? What about the trouble getting along with people and the draw of bitterness or immorality? And what about unpopularity in the world? And he deals with those things in chapters 12 and 13, again, by developing the thought of the practical impact of holiness. And we'll try to pursue those in our class next week, Lord willing. Are there any other prayer needs tonight? I know that some of you have been keeping up with Tina Oram and Darren Wake's dad. He didn't improve as much the last day or so as he did a couple of days before, but he started out really, really bad, and we need to have them in our prayers. He's in Cox South. Are there any others that we need to mention in our prayer time?